and her long dark hair was pulled back in a ponytail. My little sister. 8 going on 18. Funny, feisty, stubborn, silly. Stupidly intelligent, annoyingly sweet. Hilarious, frustrating, entertaining. The boniest, yet somehow also the softest little body to ever envelop me in a gangly web of arms and legs. A toothy smile that could shatter the hardest heart. A tough little tomboy who still wanted to believe in Santa Claus and magic. But then, who doesn't?
You shouldn't swear,
she said. Okay, I know. But you shouldn't sneak up on people.
I didn't. You just weren't listening properly.
One of the many pointless things in life is arguing with an 8-year-old. Doesn't matter how smart you are, 8-year-old logic always wins. Well, I was busy.
Doing what? Is that Dad's?
I hurriedly put the helmet back down.
Yeah, so? So what are you doing with it?
She suddenly noticed the rucksack in my other hand.
Are you taking Dad's stuff?
I loved my sister. I really did. But at times, she was an unbearable pain in the neck. She was like a terrier. Once she had hold of something, she just wouldn't let go.
Look, I'm just borrowing it, okay? Not like he uses it anymore. What are you borrowing it for?
None of your business. She folded her arms and narrowed her eyes. A look I knew meant trouble.
Tell me.
No.
Tell me or I'll tell Mum.
I sighed. I was feeling tense and on edge. I didn't really want to go back to that weird hatch in the ground. Didn't really know why we were doing this. But I had to go through with it, or I'd look like a chicken in front of the others. And now my 8-year-old sister was giving me grief.
Look, it's just boring shit stuff, okay? We're just going up the old mine for a bit.
She sidled closer.
So why do you need Dad's stuff?
I sighed again.
Right, if I tell you, you have to promise not to tell anyone else, okay?
Okay.
We found this hole that leads all the way to the center of the earth, and we're going to climb down it because we think there's a lost world full of dinosaurs down there.
She glared at me.
You are so full of shit.
So much for not swearing.
Fine. Don't believe me then.
I don't.
Fine.
A pause. I stuffed the hat, clothes, rope and boots into my rucksack, zipped it up and hefted it onto my back.
Joey.
I hated being called Joey by anyone except my sister, not least because it was such an easy insult.
What?
I said.
Be careful.
And then she ran back towards the house, feet bare and dirty, ponytail bouncing up and down. I watched her go, and I'd like to say I had some shiver of premonition, that a cloud scudded across the sky, carried by an ill wind, that birds rose and shrieked from the trees, or a sudden crack of thunder broke the still of the evening. But there was nothing. That's the problem with life. It never gives you a heads up, never offers you even the slightest clue that this might be an important moment. You might want to take some time. Drink it in. It never lets you know that something is worth holding on to until it's gone. I watch Annie skip away, happy, innocent, carefree. And I had no idea that it would be the last time I would ever see her like that. And I didn't realize that she had taken the torch. We stood around the hatch. Me, Fletch, and Chris. Hurst hadn't turned up yet. A part of me, a big part, hoped he wouldn't. We all had on boots, dark clothes, and heavy jackets, aside from Chris, who looked like he had ambled along for a day at the park in a denim jacket, jeans, and trainers. I was the only one who had brought along a miner's helmet and the rucksack with the rope in, but everyone had torches. We were ready. Still, without any tools to prise open the hatch, we were ready for nothing.
Where the crap is he?
Fletch moaned, taking out a packet of B&H. I shrugged. Maybe he's not coming. Then we could all go home and forget about this stupid plan without feeling bad or looking chicken. Chris scuffed his trainers. Fletch smoked his cigarette down to the glowing butt. I pretended to look pissed off, checking my watch, but all the while feeling more and more relieved. I was just about to suggest we call it a day and leave when I heard a familiar voice call out, "All right, lads." We all turned. Hurst loped down the slope. He wasn't alone. Marie scrambled down after him.
"What's she doing here?"
Chris asked.
"She's my girlfriend, that's what."
I felt my heart slide down to my oversized boots. As well as the fact that Marie was hardly dressed for potholing, in stonewashed jeans and stilettos, she was also clutching a carrier bag with a bottle of Diamond White poking out of the top.
"So, we all set then?"
Hurst grinned and brandished the crowbar. His voice sounded a little slurred.
"Ready?"
Fletch threw his cigarette butt to one side, where it glared hotly like a resentful red eye. Chris shuffled again, like he needed the toilet, was wearing two small shoes. He looked nervous, but not the same nervous that I felt. A sense of restless agitation radiated off him.
"She shouldn't be here,"
he muttered, almost to himself. Marie glared at him.
"Are you talking about me?"
she asked. Despite the situation, and agreeing with Chris, I couldn't help but notice that she looked really good tonight. Her hair was all kind of tousled, and the walk here, probably the cider too, had given her cheeks a flattering pink flush. I swallowed and shuffled a bit myself. She advanced towards Chris.
"Are you saying I shouldn't be here because I'm a girl? Like I'm too pathetic to do the same stuff you lot do?"
Marie could be feisty, but there was something about her that night, again, probably the cider, that had given her an even more confrontational edge. Chris shrunk back.
"No, it's just..." "What?"
"Nothing," I said quickly. "Chris was just looking out for you. We don't know what's down there. Could be dangerous." She looked as if she was about to argue again. Instead, her face softened.
"Well, that's nice. But don't worry. I can look after myself."
She took the Diamond White out of the bag, twisted the cap off, and took a swig.
"And if she can't, I'll take care of her,"
Hurst said, grabbing first her arse, and then the cider, and pouring several glugs down his own throat.
"Let's go on, then,"
Fletch muttered. I could tell he wasn't happy about Marie being here either, but for different reasons. Fletch always thought of himself as Hurst's best mate. With Marie here, he moved down a notch in the pecking order.
"Fucking right,"
Hurst said, handing the cider back to Marie. He swaggered over and wedged the crowbar under the metal rim of the hatch. On the first attempt, he stumbled. The crowbar slipped from his grip.
"Shit!"
He snatched it up and stuck it under the hatch again. Again, it slipped.
"Maybe it's stuck," I said.
He scowled at me.
"You think so, brainiac?"
He looked between Fletch and me.
"Help me, then."
Reluctantly, certainly on my part, we both moved forward. Fletch got there first. He grasped the crowbar just below where Hurst was gripping it, and they both bore down. I stared at the hatch, willing it not to move. But this time, there was a squeal. Rusted metal giving way after years of disuse.
"More!"
Hurst groaned through gritted teeth. They pushed down again, and now I could see the hatch rising. A few inches of darkness appeared between metal and earth. My bad feeling rose with it.
"Again!"
Hurst growled. Fletch roared, properly roared, and they shoved down once more. The hatch rose further.
"Grab it!"
Hurst yelled. Chris and I bent down and grabbed the edges of the metal. Marie joined us. We all pulled. It was heavy, but not as heavy as I expected.
One, two, three!
We hefted together. And this time it gave, suddenly and unexpectedly. We staggered backwards as it hit the ground in a cloud of dirt and dust, with a thud that I felt resonate up through the soles of my boots. Hurst whooped in triumph. He threw the crowbar down and high-fived Fletch. Marie grinned like a loon. Even I felt a momentary rush of adrenaline. Only Chris stood by silently, his face impassive. We all stepped forward and peered down into the hole. Fletch flicked on his torch. I adjusted the light on the miner's helmet. I expected to stare into darkness. A pitch black barely penetrated by our lights. A long straight drop into nothing. That wasn't what I saw. What I saw was worse. Steps. Metal rungs stuck into the rock like a ladder, and going straight down, way down. I couldn't even see the bottom of them. An icy chill slithered down my spine.
Shit, Hurst muttered. You were right, doughboy. It is a way in.
But to what? I thought. What the hell did we think we would find down there? Hurst looked back up. His eyes gleamed. I knew that look. Flat, dangerous, crazy.
So who's going first?
A pointless question, because he turned to me.
Thorny, you've got all the gear.
Of course. I looked back down the hole. My guts churned. I didn't want to go down there. Nothing we could find at the bottom of that long, dark shaft could be good. Nothing about any of this was good.
We don't know where it goes, I said.
Those rungs look old, rusted. They could give way. It could be a massive drop. Fletch made a long, slow, clucking noise.
What's the matter, Thorny? Chicken?
Yes, I was. Pure, feathered, egg-laying chicken. There are times in life when you need to make a choice. To do what is right, or to bow to peer pressure. If I turned and walked away now, I would be doing the same sensible thing. The others might even follow. But I could forget about being part of Hurst's gang anymore. I could look forward to spending the remainder of my school days eating lunch in a bus shelter. Still, at least I would be alive to eat my lunch.
Joe?
It was Marie. She rested her hand on my arm. She smiled a drunk, lazy smile.
You don't have to do this. If you don't want to, it's okay.
That decided it. I reached up and tightened the strap on my dad's helmet.
I'll go, I said.
Ace!
Hurst clapped me on the back. He glanced around at the others.
Already?
Nods and murmurs of agreement. But I could see the nerves on Fletcher's face. Only Hurst looked confident, buoyed up by booze and manic excitement. And Chris. Chris looked as calm as if he were taking a stroll to the shops.
Right, let's do this shit.
Hurst grabbed his tie from the ground. He knotted it around his head and grinned.
First blood.
Then, as an afterthought, he bent down and picked up the crowbar. I stared at it, a strange tight ball forming in my stomach. What are you taking that for? He grinned again and slapped the crowbar against the palm of his other hand.
Just in case, Thorny. Just in case.
The rungs were rusted. And narrow. I could just about get my toe on each one. They groaned and sagged as I placed my weight on them. I clung on desperately, praying that I could hold on for long enough to reach the bottom. Above, I could hear the others coming after me, showering bits of metal and dirt down on my miner's helmet. Even though I felt a bit stupid putting it on, I was glad now of the protection and the fact that it left both my hands free for gripping. As I descended, I counted. 10, 11, 12. At 19, my foot missed a rung. It flailed in the air, and then found purchase on solid ground. Relief flooded through me. I stepped down. I'd made it.
"I'm at the bottom," I shouted. "What can you see?"
Hurst's voice called down. I looked around, the light from the miner's helmet casting a pale yellow glow. I was standing in a small cave, barely big enough to hold more than half a dozen people. Aside from what looked like a few animal bones on the ground, it was empty. I wasn't sure if I felt relieved or disappointed.
"Not much," I said.
Hurst landed beside me with a thud. Fletch, Chris, and Marie followed. She clambered down awkwardly in her stilettos, still clutching the carrier bag of cider.
"Is this it?" she said.
Fletch panned his torch around, then spat on the ground.
"Just a shitty hole."
"Guess this was a waste of time," I said,
trying not to sound pleased. Hurst scowled.
"Fuck this, I need a piss."
He turned to the wall. I heard him unzip his pants and the gush of urine hitting the floor. The acrid smell, strong with cider, filled the small space. Chris was still staring around, frowning. I glanced at him.
"What is it?"
"I thought there'd be something more."
"Well, there's not, so..." But he wasn't listening. He started to circle the cave, like a dog sniffing out a bone. Suddenly, he stopped at a point in the rock where the shadows seemed to coalesce and deepen. He bent down. And then he was gone. I blinked.
"What the hell? Where did he go?"
Marie asked. Hurst zipped up his jeans and turned.
"Where's Doughboy?"
"Here,"
a disembodied voice called. I trained my light in the direction of the voice. And now I saw it. A gap in the rock. About 4 feet high and narrow. Easy to miss, unless you were looking hard. Or you knew it was there.
"It goes deeper,"
Chris called from the darkness.
"There are more steps."
"That's more fucking like it,"
Hurst exclaimed. He shoved me out of the way and squeezed straight through after Chris. After a moment's hesitation and another swig of cider, Marie followed, and then Fletch. I sighed, inwardly cursing Chris, and bent down to go after them. My head clanged against the rock. The miner's helmet. It was too wide. The light wavered and went out. Crap. I must have knocked the battery. I edged backwards and took the helmet off. I'd have to carry it sideways. I started to shuffle through, and then hesitated. I thought I'd heard something. A scraping, and a rattle of stones. The sound had come from behind me, from the metal rungs we'd climbed down. I looked around, but without the light all I could see were shadows and dancing spots in front of my eyes. "Hey?" I called. "Anyone there?" Silence.
Stupid Joe.
There was no one there. The noise was probably just the wind, gusting down the open hatch. How could there be anyone there? No one knew about the hatch. No one knew we were here. No one at all.
"Ain't nobody here but us chickens," I thought, a little crazily, remembering an old song my nan used to play. "Ain't nobody here at all."
I gave the darkness a final searching glance. Then I turned, squeezed through the gap, and started down after the others. 20.
"Good weekend,"
Beth emerges at my side from amidst the throng of pupils. She's looking fresh-faced and perky, and all the things I generally hate to see in someone at just before 8:30 on a Monday morning. I look at her from beneath eyelids weighted with lead.
Just dandy.
She squints at me more closely.
Really? 'Cause you look like crap.
I shuffle along the corridor.
That's what a good weekend will do for you.
Yeah. Guess when you get to your age, the hangovers take longer to get over.
My age?
You know, the middle. Stuff of crisis, spread, and prostate exams.
You really are a little ray of sunshine on a dismal Monday morning, aren't you?
Oh, I haven't got to my best stuff yet.
Let's pretend you've peaked. She winks.
Oh, you'd know when I've peaked.
Doubtful. At my age.
She chuckles, low and hearty, and actually it does go a tiny way to lightening my current dark mood.
So why did she lie?
I'm just trying to work out a way to ask her. When a year nine with boy band hair and a uniform on the borderline of acceptable skids around the corner, almost colliding with us, before he manages to gather in his momentum and screech to a halt.
Anyone mention no running in the corridors? I say briskly.
Sorry, sir. Miss, but you need to go to the toilets.
I already went, thanks.
Beth throws me a look. What's up? She asks. He fidgets nervously. I think you should just go and see, miss.
We need more than that, I say.
It's Hurst. He's got some kid in there and...
He falters. No pupil likes being a grass. Okay, we're on it.
I nod my head to indicate he can go.
And don't worry, you never saw a thing.
Gratefully, he hurries off down the corridor. I look at Beth. She sighs. There goes my coffee. I can hear muffled shouts and laughter as we approach. I push at the door. Someone is holding it shut from the other side.
Piss off, it's engaged.
Not anymore, it isn't.
I shove the door with my shoulder and we burst in. The kid holding the door stumbles into the urinals. I take in the scene. Three of Hurst's cronies stand in a loose semicircle. Hurst kneels over a kid on the floor, a Tupperware box at his side. I grab his arm and haul him up. You, stand over there. I turn to the kid on the floor.
My heart sinks. Marcus. Of course it is. Are you okay?
He nods, tries to sit up, can't quite make it. I hold out a hand, but he doesn't take it. There's something odd about his mouth.
Marcus, talk to me. Are you okay?
Suddenly he clutches his stomach, lurches over and retches. Half-eaten toast spews onto the cracked and stained tiles along with something else. A mangled mess of dark bodies and stringy legs. One of them drags itself up and tries to crawl away. I feel my own stomach give a lurch.
Daddy long legs.
I pick up the Tupperware box. It's still half full of the spindly insects. They've been making Marcus eat them. For a moment, I can't see. White spots flood my vision.
Whose idea? I ask, like I don't know.
More silence.
I said, whose idea?
My voice reverberates off the tiled walls. Hurst steps forward, lips curving into a smirk. The desire to rip it from his face is overwhelming.
It was mine, sir. But I was provoked.
Really?
Yeah.
Marcus has been calling my mum names about the cancer. Ask anyone. He glances at his band of boneheads. They all nod.
You're a liar, I say.
He steps forward to meet me until we are almost nose to nose.
Prove it, sir.
Before I can stop myself, I have shoved him hard up against the sink. I grab his hair and ram his head into the rusted taps again and again, Blood sprays up the tiled walls and decorates them in abstract patterns of red. I feel his skull splinter and crack. Several teeth shoot from his mouth and hit the floor, and I can't stop. Can't stop until... Beth lays a hand on my arm.
Why don't I deal with this, Mr. Thorne?
I blink. Hurst still stands before me, still smirking. My right hand has formed a fist at my side, but I haven't touched him. Beth takes the Tupperware box from my other hand.
Hurst, I'm a gnat's knacker away from suspending you on the spot. One more word and I will, all of you. Headmaster's office, now.
I should come with you, I say.
No, she says firmly. You should stay right here and take care of Marcus.
She yanks open the door, and they all file through, even Hurst. She turns and gives me an odd look.
We'll discuss this later, Mr. Thorne.
I had it under control. Her only reply is the slam of the door. I stare at it for a while, then look back down at Marcus. He remains half-curled on the floor, breathing heavily. Can you stand up? He nods faintly. I hold out my hand and this time he takes it. I haul him up and point at the sink. Why don't you wash your face? Rinse out your mouth. Another dazed nod. I look back down at the pile of regurgitated toast and daddy longlegs. The half-dead insect has given up and sprawls on the floor. I sigh. A teacher's work. I walk into one of the cubicles and grab some loo roll. Being school regulation, it takes several sheets to constitute a safe handful that won't disintegrate upon contact with anything wet or solid. I notice there's something in the toilet, as well as a vast quantity of sour-smelling urine. A black object bobs in the center of the bowl. A mobile phone. I flush the loo, taking the chance it's too big to go down the pipe, then fish it out gingerly and dry it on the loo roll. I look at the old Nokia and walk back out of the cubicle. Marcus turns off the tap, wipes his face on the sleeve of his blazer and blinks at me. His eyes are red-rimmed. This yours? I hold up the phone. He nods.
Yeah.
What happened to your iPhone? He stares down at his shoes.
What do you think?
Anger burns in my chest. You can't protect them all the time. I know that. You do your best while they're in school. But you can't be there on the way home. In the park. The playground. By the shops. Bullies don't stop being bullies when the bell rings.
Marcus. I'm not going to the head.
And I'm not going to make you. Beth and I both saw what happened. With any luck, Hurst will be suspended.
Yeah, right.
I'd like to contradict him, but I find I haven't got the will. You never know, I say.
Yes, I do. And you do too.
I don't reply.
Can I go now, sir?
I nod wearily. He slings his bag over his shoulder and shambles off. I remain staring down at the sick on the floor. Marcus is not my problem, I tell myself. I won't even be here much longer. But still, my irritating good side wants to help him. I try to ignore it and grab some more loo roll. As I do, I realize I still have his phone. I slip it into my pocket. I'll find him later and hand it back. I clean up the sick, grimacing, my own stomach turning, and limp from the toilets. I could go to Harry's office, but my gut tells me that my presence may only hinder the situation. Besides, I already know what will happen. I can see it now. A slap on the wrist. Detention. A deep sigh from Harry as he explains that his hands are tied. To suspend Hurst now wouldn't be appropriate, bearing in mind his mother's condition, not to mention the upcoming exams. And after all, kids will be kids. The problem is, if you let kids be kids, then before you know it, they're smearing their faces in pig's blood, pushing each other off the edge of cliffs, and smashing their mates' heads in with rocks. Our job as teachers, adults and parents, is to stop, at every level, kids being kids, or they'll tear the fucking world down around our ears. I shuffle slowly along the corridor. Empty now. Except school corridors never really feel empty. They echo with the laughter, shouts and screams of pupils long departed. Their ghosts remain, milling around me, shoving past with cries of, "Hey, Thorny!" and, "We're gonna get you, Doughboy!" The bell rings again and again as trainers, now rotted to dust, squeal around corners to classes that never end. Once or twice I think I catch a reflection other than my own in the glass of the windows. A shock of blonde hair. A small skinny kid with a mass of red where his face used to be. And then they are gone again, consigned to the register of memory.
"Mr. Thorne?"
I jump. Miss Grayson stands in front of me, clutching a pile of blue folders to her chest and staring at me coolly through her glasses.
"Shouldn't you be in lessons?"
Her tone makes me feel like I should be in short trousers. Yes, I'm just on my way.
"Is everything all right?"
"But just one of those mornings. You know, the ones that make you wonder why you became a teacher." She nods.
"You're doing a good job, Mr. Thorne."
"Really?"
"Yes."
She rests a hand on my arm. Through my shirt, her fingers feel cold.
"You're needed here. Don't give up."
"Thank you." Something which looks remarkably like a smile slips briefly across her features. And then she is gone, padding away in her sensible moccasins, cardigan and beige skirt, like the ghost of school days past. My Year 10 pupils are waiting for me when I finally reach the classroom. And when I say waiting, I mean that they are sat around glued to smartphones, feet on desks. Some make a half-hearted attempt to pocket their phones or sit up as I enter. Most don't bother, barely glancing around as I sling my satchel onto my chair. I stare at them. Despite Miss Grayson's words, I suddenly feel depressed with the futility of my job, my life, my return here. I walk around the room and hand out well-thumbed copies of Romeo and Juliet. "Phones away before I confiscate them. And I should warn you, I often get mixed up between the school safe and the microwave." There is a small avalanche of activity. "Okay," I say as I return to the front of the class. "Today's lesson. How you can all get at least a grade B for the lackluster essays you turned in last week." A murmur runs around the room. One foolhardy suspect shoots their hand up. "How's that, sir?" I sit down and take out the mountain of homework that I should have marked over the weekend. "You can sit quietly and pretend to revise, while I pretend to actually read them." I take out my red pen and look meaningfully around the room. They open their books. Lesson ended, pupils released, and marking complete. Contrary to what I may have said, I read most and some even deserved a B. I pack up my bag, turn on my phone and check for messages. Nothing. No reply from my cryptic courier. Not that I was really expecting one. That's not how these things work. Still, ever one for pursuing the futile, I try the number one more time. It rings. I frown. Another phone is ringing too. In perfect synchronization. In this room. In my pocket. I slip my hand inside and pull out the old Nokia. Marcus's phone. I stare at the handset. My number flashes up. The ringing stops. And an automated voice informs me that I have reached the Vodafone voicemail, blah, blah. I'm still staring at the phone, trying to make sense of things, anything, when someone raps loudly on the classroom door. I stuff the Nokia back in my pocket. Beth strolls into the room and perches on a desk.
Hey.
Come in, sit down.
Thanks, I will.
What happened with Hurst?
A week's detention.
That's it?
More than I expected. I've met amoebas with more backbone than Harry.
So, all Hurst's mates backed his story?
Oh, they sang his chorus like the world's ugliest boy band.
Right.
A pause. Look, about what happened.
You were right, I say. I almost lost it.
That's what I thought.
Sometimes, with Hurst, it's a bit too much like history repeating.
I know it's probably none of my business.
Probably.
But is there something more going on with you and Hurst Senior, with you coming back here?
Why do you ask?
I'm not the only one asking.
Meaning?
Word has got back to Harry that you two have history. Think he's worried it's going to cause him problems, and by problems I mean work.
No need for him to worry. That particular history is ancient.
No such thing in this place.
She's right. Arnhill has more secrets than shared genes.
Anyway, she continues, if you fancy a chat over a beer tomorrow night. I consider. I don't really want to talk about Hurst.
But I would like to talk to Beth.
Okay. Good. You're buying?
Oh, good. She grins and slips off the desk.
There's something else I need to ask her. Beth, do you know much about Marcus and his family? Why?
Just curious.
Well, his mum is a cleaner. Lauren gave you her card in the pub the other day.
I hear a dull clunk at the back of my mind. The penny dropping. I take out my wallet and fish out the card.
Dawson's Dustbusters.
There you go, said Beth. Which would make Lauren, sullen barmaid, reluctant dog walker, Marcus's sister.
And now I can see the resemblance.
The gangly awkwardness. The social weirdness.
I consider. The text came from Marcus's phone. He was in the graveyard that day.
Not a coincidence. But how did he get hold of my number? And how would he know about the graffiti? About my sister?
No. There's something more. Something I'm missing.
Marcus's mum, has she lived here all her life?
Haven't most people in Arnhill?
What's her first name?
Ruth.
And now, something stirs at the back of my mind. Just like it did on my very first day at the school gates, an old memory reawakened.
Is Dawson her maiden name?
Beth rolls her eyes.
Jesus, what do you think I am? The marriage register for every person in Arnhill? I do have a life outside this crappy village, you know.
Right, sorry. She folds her arms and glares at me.
Why do you need to know anyway?
Because I do. Because I need answers.
I think I may have gone to school with her. She sighs heavily. Actually, no, it's not. Her husband died several years ago. No loss. He was a nasty piece of work by all accounts. Lauren won't even use his surname.
And you know this how?
I helped Lauren fill in some job applications. Noticed the surname was different. She told me she uses her mum's name.
Which is?
More.
I almost palm slap my forehead.
Ruth Moore, she's so poor, gets free meals and begs for more. Ruth Moore, ugly and poor, licks up shit from the toilet floor.
Another awkward, socially impaired kid. Another victim. And yet, sometimes, those are the kids that see the most. Unnoticed, they absorb everything that goes on. The stories, the gossip, the detritus of school life, catching it, like a log bobbing in a busy river current. And no one ever realizes how much they know, because no one ever asks.
Beth is frowning. Are you okay?
Yeah, I was just thinking, maybe I could talk to her about Marcus, among other things.
You could try, but she's a little odd.
She looks at me and reconsiders. On second thoughts, you two will probably get on fine.
Thanks.
No problem. She strolls to the door. I'll see you later. I wait until the squeak of her trainers has faded, then I take out Ruth's card. Dawson's Dustbusters. On the back, a number and a strapline. No job too small, no mess too big.
If only that were true. Unfortunately, there are some things you can't just scrub away with a scouring pad and a bucket of bleach. Like blood, they remain festering beneath the surface. I know what happened to your sister. And sometimes, they come back.
21.
The terrace is small and neatly kept. It does not look poor by any means. New UPVC windows, smart wooden door, a bright hanging basket outside. A blue Fiesta is parked on the curb, Dawson's Dustbusters, written along the side in shiny silver lettering. I walk up the short pathway. A fat tabby cat lounges on the windowsill. It eyes me with a lazy contempt. At the door, I pause. Even though I've had all day to think about it, I'm still not sure exactly how to approach this. Those messages were anonymous for a reason. If Ruth sent them, she doesn't want to talk. The question is, why did she send them? I don't know Ruth. I never really knew her all those years ago. No one did. At school, she was never part of any group, never friends with anyone, never included, never picked first unless the team sport was humiliation and torment. I remember one day some of the other girls stole her knickers in PE. A gang of kids, boys and girls, armed with sticks and rulers, followed her out of school. They surrounded her as she tried to escape home, jeering, calling her names and lifting her skirt to reveal her nudity. It was cruel and horrendous, and not even sexual. It was brutal and simple degradation. I'm not sure quite how far it would have gone if Miss Grayson hadn't spotted what was going on out of a window, intervened, and taken her home. Not that home was much better. Her mum liked to drink and her dad had a temper. Not a good combination. Apparently you could hear them screaming at each other all the way down the street. About the only companion she had was a mangy old dog she used to walk up over the old colliery site. I wasn't one of the kids who bullied her. Not that day. But that's nothing to be proud of. I didn't help her either. I just stood by, watching her torment. And then I walked away. Not for the first time. Or the last. Ruth was one of those kids you try hard not to think about after you have left school. Because to do so makes you feel just that little bit worse about yourself. And I had far bigger things to feel worse about. I raise my hand to knock on the door, and it swings open. A short, stocky woman stands in front of me. She is dressed in a magenta cleaner's smock, the company name neatly embroidered on the chest. Her thick, dark hair has been cropped short, for practical rather than aesthetic reasons, I presume. Beneath the blunt fringe, her square face has the stoic look of someone who has become accustomed to disappointment. A face battered by life's small blows. They are often the ones that hurt the most. She regards me suspiciously, arms folded.
Yes?
Mrs. Dawson? I left a message earlier. I'm Joe Thorne, I'm a teacher at...
I know who you are.
Right. What do you want? The lack of social niceties evidently runs in the family. Well, like I said in the message, I wanted to return Marcus's phone. He lost it at school today. Is he here?
No.
She holds out her hand.
I'll give it to him.
I hesitate. If I give her the phone now,
I am pretty sure I will be continuing this conversation with a closed door.
Could I come in?
Why?
There's something else I'd like to talk to you about.
What?
I debate with myself. Sometimes you need to show your cards. Others, you need to play the long game.
A cleaning job?
I wait. For a moment, I think she is still going to slam the door in my face. Instead, she stands to one side.
Kettle's on.
The house is as pristine inside as out, a little unnervingly so. It smells of disinfectant and air fresheners. I feel my sinuses swell and a dull throb begin in my temple.
Through here.
Ruth leads me into a small kitchen. Another cat squats on the kitchen worktop. Grey, fluffy, malevolent looking. I wonder where the dog is. Perhaps Lauren is out walking him. I take Marcus's phone out of my pocket and place it on the kitchen table. It got a bit wet, but I think it still works. Ruth glances at it. Her face betrays nothing.
Marcus has an iPhone.
Not anymore, I'm afraid. It got broken. She gives me a sharper look.
Broken or smashed?
I couldn't say.
Of course not. No one ever can.
If Marcus wants to make a complaint about bullying,
what?
What will you do?
What will the school do?
I open my mouth, then flounder like a grounded fish. Ruth turns to the cupboard and takes out two mugs. One has a picture of a cat on. The other proclaims, "Keep calm, I'm a cleaner."
I've been up to the school, loads of times, she says.
Talked to your head.
Right.
Fat lot of good that did.
I'm sorry.
I thought things might have changed. Schools don't put up with that type of thing no more. They crack down on bullying.
That's the idea.
Yeah. Nice idea.
Crap, though.
She turns to the kettle.
Tea?
I'd prefer coffee. I'd prefer to tell her that she's wrong, that schools do crack down on bullying now, that they don't brush it under the gym mats for the sake of a decent Ofsted report, that who someone's daddy is has no effect whatsoever on their treatment by the teachers. That's what I want to tell her.
We don't have any coffee.
But we can't always get what we want.
Tea is fine.
She fills the mugs with boiling water, adds milk.
I remember you from school, she says. You were part of Hurst's gang.
For a while.
I never thought you were like the rest.
Thanks.
Didn't say it was a compliment.
I wonder how to respond. I decide to say nothing, for now. She finishes making the tea and brings the mugs over.
Are you going to sit down or what?
I plunk my backside down in a chair. She takes a seat opposite.
I heard you were renting the cottage.
Word gets around in Arnhill.
Always has.
She reaches for her tea and takes a sip. I look at the brown liquid stewing murkily in my mug and decide against doing the same.
You cleaned the cottage for Julia Morton.
That's right. Though I doubt she'll be giving you a reference.
You must have got to know her and Ben.
She wraps her hands around her mug and regards me shrewdly.
Is that why you're really here? You want to know about what happened?
I have a few questions.
It'll cost you.
How much?
A deep clean.
I remember Lauren's price list.
£50.
Cash.
I consider. I'll live with the dust. £25, and it will have to be a check.
She sits back in her chair and folds her arms.
Go on.
What was Julia like?
All right, as teachers go. She wasn't too up herself. But she thought she was better than this place. Most of them do.
And most probably are. But she wasn't depressed.
Not that I saw.
And Ben?
A good lad. At least he was, before he went missing.
What happened?
Didn't come home one day after school. Had everyone out looking for him. She pauses. And then he came back. For the first time, I sensed discomfort. A crack in the hard facade.
And?
He was different.
How?
He'd always been a polite, tidy lad. After, he'd leave the toilet unflushed. His bed was always stained with sweat and other stuff. His bedroom stank, like something had crawled in there and died.
Maybe he was just going through a phase, I say. Kids can turn from sweet youngsters into smelly teens in the blink of an eye.
She looks at me, swigs some of her tea. I used to clean there, last on my rounds. Sometimes Ben would be home from school. We'd chat. I'd make us both a cuppa. After he came back, I'd turn around and find him standing there, just staring. It used to make my skin crawl. The way he looked at me. The way he smelled. Sometimes I could hear him muttering under his breath. Foul words. It didn't even sound like him. It wasn't right.
Did you say anything to Julia?
I tried. That was when she said she didn't need me anymore. Gave me my notice.
When was this?
Just before she took him out of school for good.
I glance at my mug and wish I had a strong coffee. Strike that. I wish I had a bourbon and a cigarette.
Open the back door, Ruth says.
What?
You want a smoke? I wouldn't mind one neither. Open the back door.
I stand and walk over to the door. It opens onto a small backyard. Someone has tried to brighten it with a few wilting plants and pots. At the far end, there's a kennel. I walk back inside and sit down. I slip two cigarettes out of my packet and offer one to Ruth, then light both.
What do you think happened to Ben? I ask.
She takes a moment to reply.
When I was a kid, we had a dog. I used to walk him up at the old pit site.
I remember, I say, wondering where this is going.
One day he ran off. I was gutted. I loved that dog. 2 days later he came back, coat matted with dirt and dust, a huge bloody scar around his neck. I bent down, fussed him. He wagged his tail and bit my hand, right through to the bone. Dad wanted to throttle him right there and then.
Once a dog turns bad, he said, that's it, there's no going back. I stare at her.
You're comparing Ben Morton to a dog.
I'm saying something happened to that boy. And it was so bad his mother couldn't live with it anymore.
She drags on the cigarette, blows out a thick cloud of smoke.
Did you tell any of this to the police?
She snorts. And have them call me crazy?
But you're telling me.
You're paying me.
And that's all.
She drops the cigarette butt into her mug.
Like I said, you weren't like the rest.
Is that why you sent me the email?
She frowns.
What email?
The one about my sister. It's happening again.
I never sent you any email. Today's the first time I've set sight on you since we were kids.
I know you sent the text.
I pick up the Nokia from the table.
It came from this phone. I'm guessing it's an old one of yours that Marcus borrowed.
I never sent you any bloody text neither, and that's not my phone.
The confusion on her face looks genuine. My head throbs harder. Right on cue, the front door slams. Marcus shuffles into the kitchen.
Hi, Mum.
Then he spots me.
What's he doing here?
I brought your phone back. I say, holding up the Nokia. His face falls.
Where did you get it?
I ask.
I've had it ages.
Really? So, does this mean anything to you? Suffocate the little children? Fuck them? Rest in pieces? Guilt radiates off him like body heat.
Marcus?
Ruth prompts.
It was just a joke. A wind-up.
All your idea, then?
Yeah.
I don't believe you.
It's true.
Did someone make you send the text?
It wasn't like that. No one made me do anything.
He juts out his chin defiantly. Fine. I took the phone into my pocket. I think I should let the police deal with this. I take a step towards the door.
Wait.
I turn. What, Marcus? He looks at me desperately.
She won't lose her job, will she?
22. 1992. More steps. Different from the first. These were carved out of the rock, and they curved gradually downwards, like a staircase. A slippery, treacherous staircase. Some of the steps crumbled a bit when you stood on them, sending bits of rock skittering down below. It sounded a long way down. The walls either side were jagged, the roof above me low. I had to crouch a bit. I adjusted the battery on my helmet, but because of the curve, the light only illuminated one or two steps at a time. So sometimes it seemed like the third step was straight out into darkness. Ahead of me, I could see the other two torches bobbing up and down, but they only provided odd, abstract patches of illumination. However, they did at least confirm that nobody had fallen off the edge of a precipice and broken their neck. Yet. Occasionally, I heard one of the others curse, usually Marie. I had no idea how she was managing in stiletto heels. Beneath my miner's overalls, I was coated in sweat. It slid down my brow and trickled around my eyebrows. My heart hammered, and my breath was growing more ragged. Not just because of tension and exertion. My dad once told me there's less oxygen in the air the deeper down you go.
How much fucking further?
Fletch grumbled. Because if I was finding it hard going, Fletch, with his 10 fags a day habit, must really be struggling. I expected Hurst to reply, but Chris got there first.
We're close,
he said calmly. And I could swear he didn't sound breathless at all. Didn't sound as if he was even breaking a sweat. We resumed our unsteady, stumbling progress. After a few more minutes, I realized something. I wasn't bending over quite so much. I could stand upright. The roof was getting higher. The quality of the light seemed to be changing, too. Even the air felt a little bit more breathable, as if there was more of it around us. Getting close, I thought. But to what?
Be careful,
Chris called back now.
There's a drop.
He was right. We rounded the next corner, and the narrow passageway opened out into a much larger cavern. It was big. Really big. I looked up. The ceiling rose high above us in a rough dome shape. Thick wooden beams formed supports. They crossed and curved in a way that reminded me of the vaulted roofs in barns or churches. Similar, but more rudimentary. The steps continued, but there was no wall to our left anymore, just a straight plummet down.
Shit!
Marie suddenly yelped. Glass shattered, brittle and abrupt in the darkness.
The cider!
I jumped. My concentration wavered. The foot I was poised to place on the next step slipped. My ankle buckled beneath me. I yelped in pain and grabbed for the wall, but of course it was gone.
No wall, just air. Fear snatched the scream from my throat. I tried to grab hold of something, anything, but it was too late. I was falling. I closed my eyes.